Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Hello and welcome to episode 19 of Shifting the Paradigm. While this intro was playing, no one else can see but me, but my guest was dancing and jamming to the music, and we're going to bring him in rather shortly. I am Christina Gomez, your hostess for this next hour of adventure and UFO shenanigans, where we look and think outside the proverbial box, jump down rabbit holes, and wear the red pill is actually a red Tic Tac. I would love to say hi to everyone in the live chat. Spaghetti Lee, Paul, Alien Girl, Zofa, how are all of you guys doing? Today, I am so pumped to introduce my guest, my good friend and teammate from the debrief, Chris Plame. Chris is a fantasy and science fiction novelist, a stand-up comedian, and currently works as the head science writer at the debrief. Across his 30-year writing career, Chris has written hundreds of comedy sketches, So let me introduce you, our special guest, Mr. Christopher Plame. How are you doing, Chris?
Christina, how are you? Great to be here. Super excited to be here. Before we start, I just want to do something for my mother real quick. Carol Ann, this is for you. There you go. That was it. Just for my mom.
Yo, I got to say hi to your mom when you're on anywhere.
Well, especially here. This is the one that she watches whenever I tell her, hey, there's a new video at the debrief. She asks me, oh, is it a Christina video? And then she watches it. So since it's over here at Paradigm Shifts and it's got me and you both, she's definitely going to watch. If she's not watching live, my brother sent her the link, I think. So. Are you there? Am I freezing?
Chris?
Yeah, I'm here.
Was that me or is that you?
I don't know. I hope it's not my internet. It's not. Usually it'll give me a low speed error on my screen if I freeze, but I'm seeing you freeze. Are you seeing me freeze?
Yeah. I guess we're having a freezing party. Well, let's
probably
see.
Probably Tim McMillan again out there messing with my internet connection so I don't give all the debrief secrets out. Yeah, you know what? I'm going to go out and come back in, Christina.
Okay, I unplugged my Ethernet cable, so we're just gonna do the magic of the Wi-Fi and see how it goes from there.
Let's hope it works. Yeah, I backed out of my connection and came all the way back in, so it says my Wi-Fi is good right now. So,
oh my gosh, I mean, what you're always gonna have some kind of technical difficulties in any podcast you'll ever see or hear. Yeah. So I remember, before we even get into the questions, I remember as soon as I entered the debrief, we had Chris, Chrissy, and Christina. And I remember you saying, if you're named and start with the C, you better just get out of here. Get out of the team.
And I think there was another, like, Chrissy female right at the beginning, too, that came and went. But, yes, I think at one point there was four of us. So, yes. I can't hear you anymore. Mm. Gabby, are you there? Oh, she's going in and coming back out.
Can you hear me now?
I can. But I cannot see you.
Okay.
Oh, there you are. Now you're back.
It's just getting worse and worse. Okay, but let's go ahead and continue. So, before we even jump into a lot of the things that you write for the debrief, do you remember the very first article you ever wrote? And if you do, what was it about 30 years ago?
Well, the first article I wrote for the debrief was in December of last year. So MJ reached out to me and gave me an assignment. It was Purdue University was researching a new fabric called MXene fabric. And it was something, it's a two-dimensional material that can be used to block electromagnetic waves like a Faraday cage and could actually be built right into clothing or anything. So that was my very first article, December 8th of 2020.
But what's the very first article that you've ever written?
So I was not really a story writer or an article writer. I've been writing, as you noted, I wrote stand-up starting back in the early 90s. I wrote sketch comedy. I wrote a few TV scripts, a couple of screenplays. My first article was a basketball article for a website called Inside Hoops back in 1998. And I got hired to write some articles for them because they were doing a solicitation online. It's a sport I follow. Seemed like something fun to do on the side. So I think that was my first article was 1998.
I always feel like out of everything to write, probably sports might have to be the hardest, at least for me.
It wasn't a recap of a game or a play-by-play or anything like that. It was writing about free agency and salary caps, and it was a very mathematical article, but it was the type of thing I would read people getting it wrong all the time, and it would frustrate me. So I said, you know what, I'm going to go in and give an article to these folks that is actually accurate to how all the math in the league works. So it was well received, and it was fun to do. And I've written a number of basketball articles over the years. I write a bunch for Silver Screen and Roll, which is a Laker website here in Southern California. So,
and when you've been working for the debrief, you've written on all things to do with space technology, and the UAP topic. How did you get started in writing about this kind of topic?
So I think science in general, this is my first job writing about science. But I can tell you UAPs and UFOs is something I've been following my whole life. I tell people all the time that In Search Of ran their first episode on UFOs in 1977. And I was a little 8-year-old boy and I saw it and my father watched it with me and we were completely blown away. And we followed that show for years. And all through the 80s and 90s, I would go to even before there was an internet, I would go to the bookstore, I would go to the library, I would dig up anything I could on UFOs, as we call them UAPs nowadays. And so that's something I've been following, writing about. When the debrief found me, there was a website called UAP Research that was around all last year. And it went out of business when the founder got another job and closed it down. But he had reached out to me because I had blogged about it on my author site, plainfiction.com, where I promote my books and other writing. And I just thought, so much has happened since 2017, 2018, 2019. I mean, the last couple of years, Christine, as you know, are like nothing in the history of the topic. So for my own fun and for my book fans who are emailing me saying, hey, you know about this stuff. What's going on with all these UFOs and videos? I wrote a big, like 10,000 word, 4-part blog entry on my own website about UFOs. That led me to UAP Research. I wrote a bunch of articles for them. And because of that, I got reached out to by MJ Benias at The Debrief. And next thing I know, I was writing science articles over here. And he even told me at the time, I don't really need people to write about UAP. We have that pretty covered. But we can use someone to write about science. And that's what I was more interested in writing about. So I do cover UFOs for sure. And I've had a few doozies in the last few months of exciting articles. But yeah, writing about science was the main attraction to the gig for me. Poor Christina, you're cutting in and out there. Are you there again?
Yeah, I'm trying to like cut down the programs I'm having on my laptop. Hopefully that'll stop any.
Yeah, my clock is running clean and my own face is not jumping around. So I feel like my connection's okay for
sure. Yeah, I think it's my side. And I you mentioned the TV show, it's called UFO. Is that what you said? Is that what it's called? The one that you had watched in the 70s.
Oh, in the 1970s, late 70s, there was a show called In Search Of. And they did a later version of it where Zachary Quinto came back and hosted it. But it was basically the predecessor. The closest thing I would compare it to is Ancient Aliens. They had lost civilizations, Atlantis, mysteries of Egypt's pyramids. But they would do things like remote viewing and consciousness and shamans and ghosts. And they really did look into the things that people like you look into now. The things that are covered on Shifting the Paradigm are the type of things that you would see on In Search Of. There just wasn't a Christina Gomez yet to host it. And there was only one version of it. But yeah, it was a primetime network show talking about, among other things, UFOs.
And at the time in the 70s, was this a popular TV show?
Yeah, it was really popular. And I can tell you, I was very young, but there wasn't really anything else feeding it. You know, think about the interest you have in it. Think of this community you and I are part of that has all these people interested. And imagine there's no place to go for that information, that there's no internet, there's no slew of cable channels. You can't go, you know, to an Ancient Aliens episode or a UFO episode on Discovery Plus. So when they came out covering Atlantis and Lemuria and just all these mysteries, I mean, it was the first time I had heard of the Loch Ness Monster. It was the first time I had heard of the Bermuda Triangle. A lot of these mysteries that still exist today.
That's so exciting. Talking about the Loch Ness Monster, when I used to live in Europe, I had visited Scotland, and my dad and I went to go to the infamous lake where the Loch Ness Monster was. And let me just tell you how disappointed I was when I was 6 and never be able to see the Loch Ness Monster.
It was just a lake, you're saying, basically.
Just a very boring lake with nothing. There were no awesome creatures. Brought my camera and everything. And
was that your doing? You were like 6 and you're like, Dad, I want to go see the Loch Ness Monster?
Heck yeah.
Oh my God. So you've been this way forever?
Yeah. And there was like a huge statue right next to the lake of the Loch Ness. And I was like, I'm pumped. I brought my snacks, my camera. I am ready to like have a stakeout. And my dad was like, yeah, it's getting kind of late. We should probably just head back. We're not going to say anything today, sweetheart.
I can see 6-year-old Gomez with your little camera around your neck, your binoculars on your hip. You've got a little map. You're like, okay, so the top 3 sightings were here, here, and here. So, yeah, I can see you. Totally. I love it. That was sweet your dad didn't indulge you. My dad was the same way. My mother was very Catholic and didn't love the UFO stuff and thought I was reading about demons or might join a cult or something. But my father was totally opposite, loved the mystery stuff. He and I would sit around and talk about things like Roswell. You know, that same show, In Search Of, in 1980, was pretty much what broke that story. You know, Roswell had been in the paper back when it happened, and it had kind of existed very much in the background. And then researcher Stanton Friedman was able to interview Jesse Marcel, the first officer on the scene at Max Brazel's ranch in Corona. And that was this first, you know, sometimes you see these famous clips of Jesse Marcel saying, we don't know what it was. And they sure know it wasn't a regular balloon. And this was the first guy on the scene. That was from that show. And my father and I, the show would end and we would discuss it in depth. And somehow in that living room, we were going to figure out if aliens were real or not right there.
I definitely feel when it comes to parents, they're some of the best foundations we have when we're children with our interests, our likes and our dislikes. And I think it's amazing that you as a child and even other children are able to openly talk about these kinds of topics and have support on being able to talk about them and be like, you know what, I like that point, but I might disagree with this, this, and this. And I think without parents, we wouldn't have these kinds of interests.
Absolutely. Like I said, it was a mixed bag because as far as my mother was concerned, she would prefer that I didn't ever talk about UFOs or Atlantis or all of that stuff because, you know, she was raised very strict Catholic. And in her upbringing, that was, you know, not something that she was excited about. But she didn't stop me from doing it by any means.
Good.
And she would still take me to the bookstore. And I would go over to the occult section where they kept the UFO stuff. And yeah, so I still got that support. Then it went through my whole life. You know, my parents, as I mentioned when I was in the green room, I'm lucky enough as a 52-year-old man to have two parents that are still alive and kicking. And they supported me at the dawn of my comedy career, which led to this career in writing that I have now. And my father would come down to open mics with me at 1 o'clock in the morning in La Jolla or in L.A. And he would sit and we would come home and my mother would say, he's really good. Or he would tell my mother, he's really good. You don't understand. And you know, she rather I went to law school and became a lawyer and a senator, but was still have that support for sure.
But you love doing comedy. I mean, you would wouldn't you prefer that more than being a law student?
Look, I went to UCLA to become a lawyer. I started as a political science major. I really somehow thought like everyone had me convinced. I was a good debater and things like that, and it won some awards in debating. So. And I tell people now in hindsight, when I look back, I knew before that first college quarter was over that political science and ultimately the law was just not for me. And I didn't really feel at home at college until I joined the UCLA Comedy Club. I tell people that story all the time, but basically it was a student-run organization where you could write about, you know, learn how to do stand-up, learn how to perform. And I made a bunch of friends there, friends I still have to this day. And a handful of them who work in show business, writing and producing, the skills that they picked up in that little comedy club. So,
and skills that you will use for life. John has a question, and thank you so much. He says, now I lost. Oh, he says, have you guys heard anything about what's going on behind the scenes with regards to any bug UAP news coming up soon?
I think it means big UAP news.
Ah,
I'm going to go ahead and jump out on a limb there. I can tell you that, so I can't give anything specific away, but I can tell you this, and I've been telling people this the last couple of weeks. The most exciting thing about working at the debrief is hearing behind the scenes what those three partners are working on. When MJ Banias, Micah Hanks, and Tim McMillan are working on these sort of stories, I mean, sometimes it's just they'll send it to me and say, hey, will you give it an editorial look over? And all of a sudden I'm reading an exclusive interview with Ryan Graves at 2 o'clock in the morning, you know? So I can tell you that stuff is being worked on. I do think there is big news and I do think there's exciting things. Christina, you know, we have some events planned later in the year at the debrief here.
And one coming up just on Sunday.
Yep, at Sunday we'll be at the UFO Congress, And although our talk at the UFO Congress is titled A Year in Review, I'm also referring to it as What's Next, because I think that's what people want to hear. So, yes, we will definitely review what's happened over this last year when appropriate. But, yes, the answer to that question is things are happening. More is in motion now than has been in motion at any time. Just because that report came out in June doesn't mean we've hit a brick wall. If anything, stuff's happening.
Oh, and, you know, Lou Elizondo said the exact same thing when I had him on last week. So
great.
We can expect some interesting things that all of us might be rather shocked at.
Facial hair from being Lou. If I would just narrow that down and put on the baseball cap, I would have like an Elizondo. Maybe I'll be Lou for Halloween.
I support it. And talking about a year in review, you've written a ton of articles that can definitely be used for the meeting that we're having on Sunday. And in one article titled, NASA just released one of the most detailed high-def videos on Mars and you need to see it. And it states that the Curiosity rover released high-definition pictures of Mars, and that was released to the public in August by NASA. However, this is the however part, this rover landed in a crater in 2012. So my question is, why does it take so long to get this specific panoramic photo that we just got in August? And what about the Perseverance rover that was just recently launched and that landed on Mars? Why do you think the Perseverance rover has been so quiet lately?
So they announced today that the Perseverance rover had gathered one of its first samples. And one of the big missions, and keeping in mind that this has not been funded or perfectly planned yet, but one of the things the Perseverance rover are doing is taking samples of material that looks really interesting. And they'll say, okay, this rock, and by interesting, I mean, between you and me, I think we all know, they're searching for signs of life there. They're searching for signs of microbial life. So they will grab these samples, cache them is the term they use, but store them away for some future mission that NASA is planning that, as the article I read yesterday pointed out, it needs new technology and new planning. So it's not done yet, but there will be a mission to go up, grab those samples, and bring them back for analysis in a lab on Earth. And that literally, I think, happened yesterday or today with the Perseverance rover. On your first question on the Curiosity rover, and it took so long to put that photo together, that's an excellent question. You know, I speak to people at NASA all the time, and it's a question I'll ask. I hadn't even thought about it. That rover has been up there doing a lot of stuff. I can tell you in that video I put out and the little article around it, part of what was going on was they were showing where it was going next. And it had gotten to a nice little rise where it had a great shot of the valley. So I would suspect, without knowing for sure, that part of the motivation was, we just have a really great view here. Let's do a photo of it.
Might as well just take a selfie while you're at it.
Right? Yeah. I think it was just one of those, you know, yeah, you're standing at the edge of Grand Canyon and you go, honey, where's my phone?
What shocked me about this Curiosity rover was it got into the crater in 2012 and it's only traveled 16 miles in almost 10 years. That's what I found really interesting.
Yeah. That's just lazy.
Just lazy.
They're just lazy. You know, hey, I'm trying to keep it loose here. So with these sort of missions, you know, obviously, aside from the obvious, no one's directly there controlling it. We send control messages and the radio signals takes, you know, many minutes to get there. And then the operation, when they plan a mission like this, they find an area that they think is the most tantalizing. They land there. I think that one's in Gusev Crater. I'm not sure. I don't remember for sure, but I think it's in Gusev Crater. And it lands there, and it really is just analyzing that little area that it is. You know, it's not designed to traverse miles and miles, but basically to be a little localized lab that has the ability to move around and look for interesting things.
Maybe they should change the name from Curiosity Rover to just like Chill Rover or something.
Yeah, exactly.
Didn't go very far.
Somewhat interested Rover. Casually observant Rover.
I don't see why not. We should write a petition and change the name.
Right.
But you... I'm sorry, Chris. You've also written several articles about Mars, having to do with photos released to the public, missions that have been launched to reach Mars, and potential life that could be on Mars. With everything that you have learned and researched, what are your current thoughts on Mars? Do you believe that there once was or still is life? And do you believe that enough effort in research is being made on the planet Mars?
Yes, yes, and yes. So I do think there's a very good chance that microbial life will be found on Mars. I even think there's a chance that back when it was a very wet planet, that things more complex than microbial life, and we may find fossils of aquatic animals or small land animals. I don't think those things are off the table. In 1978, when the I think it's the Viking mission went to Mars, they believe the scientists that worked on that mission, some of which are still alive today, believe they found life then. They scooped up some material, put it in the little oven on the rover, cooked it up, analyzed the gas, and said, yes, these are signs of life. Now, since then, there wasn't enough independent confirmation, and it was one simple test. But I can tell you that the NASA scientist who was in charge of the program, and I reference him in one of those Mars articles, his name is not coming to me right now, but he believes to this day that they've, you know, that was a headline of the article he wrote for Scientific American about 3 years ago, was, I believe we found life on Mars in 1978. And everything I have read has compelled me to feel that he's probably right. And all of these missions since, when you look at the rovers that Spirit and Opportunity, when they went up, they pretty much prove that wet past. The Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter, they have pretty much proved full-size lakes, maybe even small oceans, and now these newest rovers are getting down to that nitty-gritty. I would not be the least bit surprised. As a matter of fact, I would go so far as to say, I would be surprised if we don't find life on Mars. That would surprise me.
How long, in your opinion, do you think it would take for us on Earth to know that there is life on Mars, to get evidence?
So, I think the good news is it's going to happen soon. I think the bad news is that's soon from a scientific term. So I think 9 or 10 years from now is when they're planning on sending. That's the rough range NASA's using for the sample return, Mars sample return mission I was talking about, where they would go up, grab the samples that have been stored in Perseverance, and bring them back to a lab on Earth for more detailed study. I don't think any of the rovers we have there now or any of the planned missions coming up will be quite sophisticated enough to 100% confirm that. And I think that's why there is this focus on bringing that back here, where we could really analyze it in a laboratory setting and run hundreds of different tests. Because if we come, as I pointed out in 1978, he said, okay, we found life, and people said, rightfully so, we probably need a little stronger confirmation than that. So I think that's where we are, Christine. I think 9, 10 years from now, I think we will have that answer. And based on the pace of the UAPTF and a lot of things that are happening with the Galileo project and NASA, we might find something interesting about life not on Earth before then.
What do you think the chances are of finding marine life on Europa and Ganymede?
Very high. I hear that a lot. Those were targets. You're talking about the moons of Jupiter and moons of Saturn that are icy moons. And yes, there's a lot of feeling. And this is something I tell people all the time. I say, you know, 20 years ago, NASA didn't have astrobiologists. They did not have astrobiologists. They didn't even have a planetary protection officer, which they have now, which is essentially the person's job to make sure our missions going to other places don't pollute it with our microbes, as well as we don't bring back a killer virus or bacteria that wipes out a chunk of, if not all of our planet. So all of those people and all of those positions, that's what they do. There's now a people within government, within universities, people within these organizations, that their entire job is astrobiology, looking at life on other planets. And yes, I would not be the least bit surprised that the better we get at surfing our own solar system and the better we get at searching those moons and other planets, that we might find all kinds of life across our own little solar system.
I sure do hope so, especially in our lifetime.
I think there's a good shot in your lifetime, Christina, that's for sure.
Oh, let's get it tomorrow. Should have gotten it yesterday. Right? Should have gotten it yesterday.
I was on the Fearscape Paranormal podcast yesterday, and I told the guys, I said, you know, you do reach an age in this search for UFOs and some of these other things where you do start to ask yourself, will I be here to see the answer or not? But for the first time really in my life since 2017, I really feel like a lot of things are close. I feel like a lot of things are imminent.
And with that being said, we're going to jump into a very quick intermission.
Hi, I'm Micah Hanks, and let me tell you something. I support Christina Gomez as a Patreon subscriber, and here's why you should too. She brings all of her unique insights to a whole new generation, and all while she's also going through college. Listen, support Christina, become a Patreon subscriber today. You won't regret it.
Alrighty, gave me enough time to fix the camera.
You had to fix what?
The yellow. There's like a little yellow tint going on, so I fixed it.
Yeah, and my whole room went like slightly darker, and my lights are right on me, so I don't know what's happening.
Probably just switched. In August, you wrote an article called "These 7 Star Trek Technologies May Soon Become a Reality." And let me just tell you, probably one of my favorite articles that you've written, because it all touches a little bit of our nerdy side when it comes to Star Trek, but like, it could be real life. So I loved reading it.
when MJ hired me, he said, "Chris, you're my fiction writer. So I want you, when you can, I want you to tie that bridge between science fact and science fiction as often as you can." And that was a story I was working on for a while, but our friend Micah Hanks, who we just saw on the screen, wrote an article about a group of scientists who had learned how to detect life remotely. So they were up in a helicopter, and they could scan the ground and say, "Oh, there's signs of life there. There's signs of life over there." And of course, people who watch Star Trek go, "Yeah, they scan for signs of life all the time, whether it's with a little handheld tricorder or they do it from orbit." And that ticked something in my brain. And I said, "You know, I think Mike is onto something." And I started digging through, looking for that. Like, where are we on transporters? Where are we on warp drives? Where are we on food replicators? And I found we were a lot closer on the vast majority of things from Star Trek than I would have guessed. And a number of which, as people have pointed out, I mean, tablet PC computers, they were carrying them around on Next Generation before we had iPads. Talking to your computer by voice was something they did in the original Star Trek. Now I talk to Alexa 100 times a day. So those things, a lot of things have just straight up become reality. And it was a fun article to write. It was a fun article to research. It did get a lot of positive response. And I can tell you there are some sequels coming with Star Wars and Stargate and some other sci-fi shows that, once again, shockingly, movies and shows predicted the future.
And out of the 7 pieces of technology that you talked about in that specific article, which one are you looking forward to the most?
So although I write about warp drive a lot, and I have a big one-on-one interview with Sonny White coming out, Harold White, Sonny White, who was the warp drive pioneer over at NASA and now has his own group, I feel like warp drive is probably 50 to 100 years away. And that's me not knowing anything, just the scientists I talk to. I think something like that is viable, and I think there is a real possibility that warp drive may be within our lifetime. Unfortunately, the one technology I touched on in there that I think we would all like the most, or at least is the one that everyone asked me about, is The Transporter. And I really feel like The Transporter is something that's not going to happen. And that's, again, that's my opinion. I can tell you the one I'm really looking forward to is the food replicator, because I'm tired of cooking.
I feel you on that one.
Yep.
I like just putting stuff in the oven, letting it do its own thing after it's been frozen. But I'm really happy that you brought up several that I genuinely wanted to talk about. One of them being is the food replicator. You also mentioned in that specific article that there is something kind of already coming to us in present day. It actually came out in 2016 called Food Inc.
Yep.
That blew my mind. Could you talk a little bit about that?
So I just did a little research on them, but they were basically a pop-up restaurant, I believe, popped up in New York, and they pop up from place to place, Food Inc., and they were the first what they call printed food. So just what you would think, like a 3D printer prints physical components. They had developed a machine that you could load up with all these different ingredients, and it could more or less print you a tray of food. And I think the first people to do it were in a hospital, where they were doing it on a more like industrial scale, like here's your scoop of potatoes, here's your scoop of peas. But I believe Food Inc. is legitimately creating complex meals with a 3D printer.
That's what I was a little bit confused about as well, and like how it actually created food in 3D. I didn't get how it worked, but it also shocked me how their restaurant, their utensils, and their plates were also made out of 3D printers as well. I was like, oh my gosh, that's insane.
Yeah, really? You could rent a store space, bring in a materials printer and a 3D food printer, and print up the tables, chairs, plates, right? Just print up everything and put it all together right there. But yeah, they are printing food. As far as getting to a replicator like in Star Trek, and I mentioned this at the end of that segment, to my understanding of the technology of Star Trek, the replicator works a lot like the transporter, where it essentially takes a programmed description of food by code and uses raw material to essentially manifest or create the food item. That's something that's probably, you know, if it's a reality, again, it falls under that same issue with the transporter, which current technology has a hard time getting us there. So,
yeah, absolutely. And there was another movie, like I think in the early 2000s, called Spy Kids, and they had something very similar, but they used water molecules to create the food. But apparently it didn't taste very good.
Very cool.
Jack Frost has a question, and he says, and now I lost it yet again. So what do you think about the Alcubierre drive?
So that's a great question, and I can tell you this, and I mentioned it in that Star Trek article. A warp drive was just something that people dreamed of. It was just it goes fast, and it goes faster than light, and it was just this science fiction idea. And in 1994, Mexican physicist Miguel Alcubierre Moya, he basically sat down and said, is this viable in math? Is it mathematically viable to create something that can go faster than light speed without violating the laws of physics? And he did. He proved it. He laid out the basic math for how you would build a craft that someone could safely ride inside and go faster than the speed of light. Now, there were a bunch of limitations to his original design, and not the least of which he was using things called negative energy and exotic matter. And like multi-dimensions or some other things in physics, they're theoretical. So he had to use theoretical solutions to get to his answer, but he could still make it consistent. And it honestly, it's a great question because it is the basis pretty much for warp drive mechanics and warp drive theory that have come since. Whether it's Sonny White or the people I reported on out of Chicago that were trying to patent a warp drive, the group out of Switzerland who's building a not faster than light, but a nearly fast to light warp drive, and a bunch of other, Dr. Eric Lentz has a warp drive concept. They all more or less fall back on the mathematics laid out by Miguel Alcubierre.
Right, but now presently they're trying to focus away from using exotic matter. Do you know what they're using instead or what they're putting in their math equations?
That I don't know. I can tell you that the one that isn't going to go faster than the speed of light, the group, I can't think of their name. They are not using exotic matter, but at the same point, they're not proposing they can exceed light speed. I can tell you that Sonny White at NASA, or who was at NASA and is now at the Limitless Space Institute, and I have, like I said, some stories coming out on them, they are working on that. And they're working on one that still uses exotic matter, but uses significantly less. So Miguel Alcubierre's needed about a Jupiter size amount of something highly theoretical. And Sonny White got it down to about, like a RV size amount of exotic matter. So although we're not creating exotic matter, although scientists did recently lay eyeballs on it, and that's a story I have coming out. So it's not, it does exist. Exotic matter has moved into the feasible.
Grabbing it,
building a ship out of it, manufacturing with it, creating something out of it, that I don't know yet. And that's obviously, we're so new in this. But yes, there are a number of exciting concepts about faster than light. I have some, Christine, I have some coming on traversable wormholes and scientists that have worked out the math on that they feel those are viable. I have a couple of other concepts on warp drive. So although Dr. Alcubierre laid the groundwork for everybody, it created the opportunity for scientists to look at it legitimately, and they are, a lot of them.
And Lou Elizondo said on the podcast last week that, in his opinion, he believes that the U.S. government is in possession of exotic matter. And I found that really interesting, especially in the conversation that we're having right here, right now.
Interesting.
Very, very. Yeah, so does that mean maybe we could see it in our lifetime at the warp drive? Hopefully.
That would be awesome.
Could you imagine? I can't. I can't even imagine that. That'd be awesome.
Yep. Hey, I'm still waiting for my anti-gravity skateboard for Back to the Future 2. So as soon as I get that, I'm good to go.
Tell me about it. There was one more thing I wanted to touch on that article, because this article is beautiful. I loved every word that you wrote. And the one that you mentioned as well were the transporters. Now, you said that it's not really possible, at least right here, right now, to create a transporter. Could you explain why that is?
So the idea of a transporter in Star Trek, and I actually, for each one of these technologies, along with researching the current science, I went ahead and went to StarTrek.com and to the fan sites to read what the interpretation of the actual Star Trek technology is. How are they describing it as being done? And the transporter is basically described as scanning you at atomic level to create a pattern, transfer that pattern to a new location, and then essentially use the same technology as the food replicator to manifest a new person with that exact material. So I think there's a couple of limitations. One I pointed out in the article is, if that were exactly how it worked, you would be dead, and the clone of you would believe they were you, because they would have every single memory of yours right up to the moment you were scanned. And the minute they get here, go, oh no, I'm me, because they would have all your memories and everything. So there's just an inherent philosophical issue about that. As far as the technology, as far as actually doing it, I have read nothing and found nothing where matter, meaning the stuff we're made of, has been transported from one location to another. So there is something known as quantum teleportation, and it's in the literature. I mentioned it in that section in the article, and it's a proven thing. Transfer of information at the quantum level, what Einstein called spooky action at a distance, or what we call quantum entanglement, is basically this idea that subatomic particles that are entangled with each other can be separated by a great distance, And whatever effect, primarily the spin, but whatever effect you make on one is identical to the other one. So it is reflecting the other one. So there's this instantaneous faster than light change. So the idea of quantum teleportation of information is not only theoretical, it's proven. It's something they are able to do in laboratories. Teleportation of matter is still something that exists in science fiction. So, and I have yet to see any science working specifically towards something like a transport.
And while we're still talking about Star Trek, but away from the article that you wrote,
sure,
have you watched the recent Star Trek Discovery and Star Trek Picard?
I have to plead guilty in not being as current on my Star Trek as I need to be. So I have not watched either. My wife has fallen in love with Patrick Stewart since he did a movie called Coda. And so she's been encouraging me that she will sit down and watch Picard with me. So I finally have someone to watch it with me. So yes, I will watch Picard. Discovery, I saw when it first premiered. I saw about 3 episodes. And then I started some work in a new company that moved my schedule all around. And it was just suddenly not an option for me. So I just fell out of the new Star Trek series. But you can ask me anything about Next Generation.
Well, when you get a chance, I recommend watching Discovery. The first several seasons are pretty darn good. And I know that Picard's going to have their second season rather soon. Well, that leads me to my next question. Have you seen The Expanse? It's a rather new
Have you
TV
been talking
show.
To MJ? So I had this conversation with our boss, MJ Benias, this morning.
And so this morning.
Yeah, literally this morning we were, well, because we were talking about this, you know, this article, this Star Trek 7 Technologies, has shown up in a lot of different places. It's the article of all the UFO stuff we do, of all the things I've done. It's the one I've been asked the most about. And
really?
It's generated the most excitement because it's something we see. So he and I started talking about these follow-ups that we can do, these other science fiction series, maybe even technologies of James Cameron from the Alien movies or Avatar movies. There's so much wealth in science fiction. And he said, well, I want to do something on The Expanse because that's just about the best show on television. So I have yet to watch it. I've been told by everyone I would love it. I have a creative issue. I'm in the middle of writing a science fiction novel. So when I'm writing in a field, I don't really watch entertainment in that field because I try not to be influenced. So although I read the first 4 Game of Thrones books, when my first fantasy novel came out in 2015, I haven't watched Game of Thrones. I haven't been able to watch the TV series or read the last couple of books because I just don't want that influence in my fiction. I want my stuff to be as fresh and as original as possible. So The Expanse, MJ's going to do some things on the technology in The Expanse, though, for the debrief. So, and he's an awesome writer, so I would look for that.
Well, you have to watch The Expanse. I hopefully season 6 will be coming out in December, or still not too sure, but it's such a great TV show. And I was pretty hesitant when I heard about it. Everyone's like, yeah, you should watch it. You're going to love it. And I'm thinking, nah, I can't be that good. I binged watched all 5 seasons in like
2 years. Did you really? I love it.
I was like, this is actually really, really good. And
I think MJ is this close to making it like a job requirement for me. So something tells me I'll be watching it soon.
You really will like it. Talking about novels that you had just mentioned,
sure.
How long does it usually take you to write a novel? And what are some of the biggest challenges you have when you write a novel?
I've written 3. I have my 4th one coming out, and I have a manuscript done for a 5th novel. So they've all been different. The first novel I started writing in 2010, and I didn't put it out until 2015. So it was literally a 5-year process. It literally took me 3 years to get what I would call a first draft manuscript.
What?
Then another year of editing myself over and over, rereading the same book over and over till it sounds right in my head, which is what I do with articles. I'm very proud of my debrief stories. When you read that, that's something that I've reread 100 times to get it right. And so that's what happened with that first book. And then all of 2015, the book came out at the end of that year. I spent the entire year working with an editor, a professional editor, to get it right. So that one took that long. Book two in that fantasy series, I wrote the first draft manuscript in 59 days.
And count.
So something that had taken four years in the first book took 59 days in the second book. Now they're not all going to be that fast, but yes, they're definitely. It's really comes down to time and rhythm and how much coffee, noodles and vanilla ice cream.
Coffee for you. What's your favorite food that you have to have when you're writing? What fuels you?
So my wife has this stuff. It's called, we call it turbo tea. Now, it doesn't have caffeine in it because caffeine makes me insane and I can't sleep for 3 days. But this stuff, I can drink a glass of this in the morning and I get that like fresh, clear energy and it can go for 12 hours. I can write all day. Now, the next day, I'm a total effing mess. But that day... So on long form writing days, like if I'm writing a big feature, I had a big feature at the debrief about a guy who's developing an anti-gravity ship in his shop in New Jersey. And that feature took weeks of work and days of interactions and interviews. And then the actual day to write the story was about 10, 12 hours of work. So that turbo tea, whatever it is, I'll take a picture of it and I'll tweet it out. So if any of your followers are like, what is this turbo tea? We read about it. Like I said, she's a health maniac. My wife's a runner and a yoga enthusiast and super into nutrition. And I read about this and to this day, she says, Chris, it's your greatest find, the turbo tea.
I have so many questions on it, but we're not going to get into it. Just send me a picture, and I will research it. Essence has a question, and it says, will the James Webb Space Telescope be able to look at exoplanet to find life, looking for biosignature and technosignatures, and what will the scientific community reaction look like if an exoplanet has possible life? It's a good question.
The people that do this for a living at NASA, at various universities, people I've spoke to at international organizations that have time booked on the James Webb Telescope, I can't remember, and maybe it's because I'm reporting on it now, but maybe I can't remember in my lifetime this much anticipation for a scientific instrument.
Tell me about it.
Oh, let me tell you. We were talking earlier about a sample return from Mars. And finding life on Mars maybe in 10 years, the James Webb Telescope may find signs of life on another planet next year. It's going up in December. A bunch of the, like for instance, there's a star system called, around the star itself is TRAPPIST-1, and the planets around it, I think there's 7 or 8 planets in that system, and at least 3 of them are Earth-sized rocky planets that sit more or less in the star's habitable zone. That there's an entire team who has booked time on the James Webb just to look at those planets. As a matter of fact, I spoke to 4 different groups, including a group from France, a group from Canada, and 2 American groups, all with time booked on the James Webb telescope, all to look at planets in the TRAPPIST-1 system. That's how encouraging that is. And yes, do I think we will find biosignatures in the atmosphere? Yes. Will we debate them? Yes, just like the potential biosignature we found in the atmosphere of Venus. But I think we may find some very robust ones. I think with the range of planets, with the ability, because think about it. Imagine the Hubble telescope is a pair of binoculars, right? You're standing on the mountain and you're looking for You know, say you're looking for a buffalo in the distance, right? Or what? I don't know. I watched a Western last night. So, right. You're standing on a mountain. You got your binoculars. You're looking for buffalo. And you say, I see a bunch of little dots there. They might be buffalo. And then somebody pulls up with an actual, like, astronomical telescope that can take you right into, like, the face of that buffalo. That's the difference between Hubble and James Webb. Hubble was is a visual spectrum telescope that can more or less kind of look around, and it's found tons of stuff by looking around. James Webb's telescope is an infrared telescope that can look so much closer at such deeper distances with so much more accuracy. We're going to see and find things with that telescope the same way Hubble did, the same way Hubble opened up the window. I mean, we didn't even know exoplanets existed, you know, before you know, that didn't really come into play until the 90s. Yeah. So, and Hubble opened that up. Well, now, woo, this James Webb, it's going to change the game, in my opinion.
I can't wait. And it's going to be launching so soon. Thank you so much, Essence. That was a really, really fun question. It got Chris all hyped up. If you could tell, he's getting a little excited.
James Webb is a big deal. That's a really exciting, I mean, that's as advanced a piece of astronomical equipment as ever been put into space. I can't overstate how valuable that telescope is going to be.
Oh, I'm excited when they...
Specifically for finding signs of life and possible technosignatures.
I'm excited. I'm really excited.
Me too. Imagine we look through that telescope, Christina. We spot a planet's atmosphere, and there's enough gases in that atmosphere, oxygen, methane, enough signatures that we say the only thing we can think of that would do that is life. And we say to ourselves, we found a planet that we don't know how complex the life is, but there's life there. Imagine what that does. Imagine what that does to this field. Every deep space mission we've ever talked about gets scrapped and the whole budget gets poured into a probe to go there. That's my opinion. I don't know if it'll happen, but I think that changes everything.
It does. It does. And, you know, we've had the pleasure in talking to Jacob Hack-Mishra, who's also excited for the telescope and who's also an astrobiologist. Because you've spoken to him several times through email, sure. Right? Right.
Yes.
You've written several articles. And could you just kind of talk about what those articles were kind of covering over when it comes to astrobiology, Jacob Hack-Mishra, and possibly incorporating it with the James Webb Telescope?
He has a group called the Blue Marble Institute, Dr. Hack-Mishra, and basically that's what they do. They're at the cutting edge of looking for signs of technology, exobiology, as well as techno signatures. And they've written a number of science papers. He partnered up with, oh boy, I'm forgetting the names because I speak to so many scientists every day. But, yes, they are at the leading edge of that, the Blue Marble Institute. And they have NASA contracts and work in that same field as these people doing that. So I don't know that there's anything, I don't think that he's booked for time on James Webb. I don't know that there's an active project underway, but I can tell you what Jacob is indicative of to me. And I tell people this all the time. This is the biggest change. And you can quote me on this, Christina. I tell people all the time, people don't change their minds. Not in my opinion. I haven't seen the world many people change their minds in their life. What happens is old people with old ideas die and new people with new ideas are born. Okay? And that's my quote. I use it all the time. And Jacob Hack-Mishra to me is representative of an entire generation of scientists who grew up with the idea that they feel life on other planets is more likely, not less likely. And I can tell you, growing up in the 20th century when I did, and growing up in the 70s and 80s, again, I pointed out, but we didn't know there were other planets. We didn't know so many things that we do now. We didn't know there were rocky planets. We didn't know we'd find any in the habitable zone. So many, much less the frequency. So the idea of life on other planets was just that in the 20th century for most of it. It was science fiction. It was, you know, we had barely gotten a man to the moon. So the idea of other planets and other things. But I can tell you what, science and ufology, I think they're getting ready to meet in the middle. I mean, what happens when we start? What happens if the James Webb Telescope says, all right, we've looked at 20 planets that might have life and 19 of them seem to have life. What do we do then? What does the conversation move? So if the idea is that UFOs, at least some of them, may either be probes from another planet sent here or may actually contain biological entities inside them flying here to visit, I think that just continues to become more real as science moves forward. So I think guys like Jacob Misra, these people I talk to, Sharon Teitel, Dr. Teitel, these people I talk to that are astrobiologists and looking for technosignatures, that's becoming the majority. If I talk to a scientist under 45, under 40, they are operating from, they believe there's life and they're looking for it, as opposed to, it might be there, we might as well look for it.
You can't avoid it anymore. There's no way. You know, there's no way it can be a conversation that you can say, no, they're not real.
It's imagine you live in the middle of a garden that's 1,000 acres in every direction, and you're looking at your feet and there's a flower growing, and somebody tells you all around you the garden is exactly the same. What are the odds that that's the only place a flower would grow? And that's the thing I tell people all the time. When you look at these other Earth-like rocky planets, they're not made of something other than, there are only so many elements. There's only so much material. It's all made of the same stuff. So if that garden here on Earth are the right mix of dirt and water and radiation and all of these elements, created life that is so pervasive that it is everywhere on this planet, even places we never thought it would be. Extremophiles exist in places we never thought they would be. So the idea that there isn't other planets was the big argument. When that got put away, oh, they're not around. They're not going to be rocky. They're not going to be in the house. All of those things have gone away. All we're saying is, did life only happen once here? And is so pervasive, it's everywhere on this planet in all of these different forms. That almost seems like religious thinking to me. To me, the thinking is more, it's a very simple piece of rock. We're flying around on a dirty raindrop that's orbiting the sun, right? It's just salt water and dirt and all that. That's everywhere. That's all in the cosmos. And there's planets just like Earth all throughout the cosmos.
And that's all the time we have for today's show. I want to thank all of you for joining Chris and I today. Thanks for the lively chat and the super chats. Y'all are always awesome. I want to thank Chris so much for coming to the show. Chris, can you take a moment to tell us where they can find you on social media and where they can find your books?
So I always tell people the top three places. First of all, just go to The Debrief every day because we're putting out stories every day. We're adding writers, we're adding content producers. So that's the best place to find. If you want to know what's going on and you're looking for what's going to happen next in the UAP story, what's going to happen next in cutting edge science where it meets science fiction, that's where I write that stuff. And to reiterate an earlier point, there's a lot of great stuff coming from those guys and myself as well. As far as me personally, there's two places to look. One is just my website, plainfiction.com, and that's my last name, P-L-A-I-N. The word fiction, because that's what I write over there, is novels. And that is my Twitter as well, is @plain_fiction, because somebody took the one without the underscore.
Well, there you go. I want to thank Chris yet again. And I want to say a huge thank you to all my Patreon supporters. I'm so humbled by all those that support me, my work, and this channel. For my Patreon supporters, we will do another 15 minutes of Q&A, which will be posted on the Patreon site later tonight. Everyone have a spectacular weekend. Be safe. And remember, keep your eyes on the skies.